attenuation with the signal over large distances. And so again, you move short distances, there's not much change in the large scale Feynman effect. Unfortunately for us, even moving short distances can cause significant change to the received power, so it can fluctuate a lot over short distances or short periods of time. These types of effects are going to be referred to as small scale Feynman. Okay. And so large scale fading are mainly going to deal with by just adjusting the power level. Small scale fading is more difficult to adjust to. Okay. So there's two main factors that affect the effects or cause the small scale fading effects. Multipath properties, and then motion, so the speed of the sender relative to the receiver. The effect that these small scale fading effects have is further influenced by the bandwidth of the signal. Okay. And so in particular for narrowband signals, you can have an effect that sort of essentially eliminates the signal, whereas if you have wideband signals, you end up having distortion that possibly be able to recover the signal. And this occurs because typically these small-scale fading effects are very frequency dependent. Okay. So if we go back to our two-path case and just look at the signal and the amplitude of the signal. It's squared by two signals. And we see that, again, the change comes in the time difference that takes the two signals to arrive. And the phase difference for the two signals, and potentially the frequency will also play into it. Okay. If you examine multipath effects, then they have an impact on these time and phase. Now, there were impacts on these time and phase differences. The frequency change is motivated by motion. Speed moving towards or away from sender and receiver. Okay. So we're going to keep the mathematics fairly light for this. And again, just trying to understand so what impact these effects are having. I should say, at least for the moment. And so we'll consider the effects separately. For multipath properties in small scale fading, there are a number of statistical models. So they're mathematical predictions based on statistical models of, again, how this very complex system is put together. These statistical models break down into two types. You have Ricean fading, which is curves where you actually have, you still have your line of sight. So you have a dominant path above. It doesn't have to be line of sight. You have a dominant path. You have a refraction or reflection. And more fine level. Rayleigh fading occurs where there is no signal dominant path, but signal is really a combination of all. And so the impact is in phase and amplitude of the signal, and small changes in distance can have a significant, make a significant change, and this is going to vary depending on the frequency you're at. Okay. So that accounts for amplitude and phase. Frequency changes, again, are caused by Doppler effects. And so you've probably heard something about them in some prior class, I'm guessing. Yes, one anyway? Okay. But anyway, the idea with the Doppler effect is that if you're moving to or towards or away from an object, you're changing the distance from the object, which causes a change in phase, but that the change, continuous change in phase, looks like frequency. Looks like a change in frequency. So the change in frequency due to motion is referred to as a Doppler shift. And we look at one specific case where we have our sender moving at some velocity v along path d while receiving signal from a remote source. Okay. We have a source up top here, and we have our receiver driving along. And so what we see is that as they move, the length of the path changes slightly. We refer to the change in the distance the signal has to move as delta L, and so we also know that there's the car is not moving directly towards the sender, but it's moving along some trajectory relative to path to the sender that is given by theta. Okay, so the change in the path length then is given by d cosine theta, and d is related to the velocity at which your receiver is traveling, so it's just v then t. You're traveling at a certain speed for delta t and that. The change in phase is related to the change in the path length relative to the wavelength. And again, substituting in for the change in path length, we get this. Okay. So that's our change in phase, but the change in phase relative to time, or relative to differential time, is a change in frequency. So our frequency shift is given by 1/2 pi, change in phase divided by the change in time. And so that becomes the orbit of the sun. If the mobile unit is moving towards the direction of the sender, then you get a positive shift. If you're moving away from the direction of the sender, you get a negative shift. So your frequency decreases if you're going towards the source, and then decreases if you're going away from the source. Okay, so again, those, the multipath and the Doppler shift, create changes in everything about the symbol in the amplitude phase and perceived frequency. Okay. And again, what impact this has on the signal is going to depend on, furthermore, the characteristics of the signal, the bandwidth or period, the bandwidth and so on, the period of the signal, the immersive proportion. So, signals traveling on different paths experience different delays, and that's referred to as a delay spread, and signals on different paths experience different Doppler shifts, so that's referred to as the Doppler spread. So that's going to, that's what's going to impact on, you know, again, the delay spread is the amplitude and the phase, the Doppler spread is the frequency change. Okay. And so what we tried to do is figure out something about how long we have over the channel before its impact is felt. So this again can be viewed either in terms of time or frequency domain. And in terms of time, we have the coherence time, which is again a statistical measure of the time duration over which the channel response is essentially invariant. And so it's the time over which the signals aren't likely to be too different from each other. Okay. And so the greater the Doppler spread, the smaller the coherence time. And again, we have the coherence bandwidth, which is a measure of the range of frequencies over which the channel can be considered flat. Okay, so that, so all components will be passed along equally, the well and bad way. Okay. And again, this is the maximum range over which signals will be similar. Coherence bandwidth is related to the multipath structure of the channel, and again, the greater the delay spread, the smaller the coherence bandwidth. Okay. Based on these, you get a number of different small-scale fading effects. Flat fading refers, and again, these effects are relative to the actual signal. So in flat fading, components of the signal attenuate at roughly the same amount. So this is based on multi-path effects, and while the signal the amplitude signal may vary with time, the spectral characteristics are constant. So the frequency characteristics are kind of constant. Okay, typically,
flat fading can lead to deep fades, which can be
counterbalanced by higher
transmit powers.
For frequency selective fading, over the signal bandwidth, you'll have points that the characteristics of attenuation are not the same for all the frequencies within the bandwidth of the signal. And so, again, what this means is that you're going to have signal distortion. If you need an exact replica of your signal, then this can be much more difficult to recreate. On the other hand, if you're just looking for bits, you can possibly
sort them out reasonably okay.
So, flat
versus
frequency selective fading refers to the channel bandwidth relative to the signal bandwidth. You can also characterize fading with time, and you can have either fast or slow fading.
Okay.
With fast fading, you'll get changes within the duration of the symbol, and so again, this is hence all the happenings of beta rays. Within slow fading, then the changes occur at a slower rate than the transmitted than the data rate of the baseband signal. And so in this case, you should be able to recover individual bits.
Okay, so again, this is just a
summarization of the various different effects and when they will occur.
Okay, so what does this actually mean in terms of what we have?
Typically, it means that we get fading when you combine the effects of large scale and small scale fading, you get complex representations. Okay, so if we look at our figure here, our signal levels in decibels, and if you look at free space loss, that would just be decreasing at a constant rate. Our shadowing effects lead to sort of slow changes in our distance. This is referred to here as the long normal fading, so this is still a large scale fading effect. You can see that at a relatively slow pace, you are going to get changes due to changes in terrain. And then on top of this, you're getting our small scale fading effects that are happening using rapid changes in the signal. And the one that appears are And so, again, what you need to try and do is recover as much of the signal as possible. And so, again, you have, if you're at a specific point, then you know sort of your large scale picking properties, which are half of the free space loss plus shadowing effects. And then on top of those, we have these small scale picking properties, which can induce higher dips. And so you, of course, at the very least, want to account for the large scale fading effects. And then you need to determine sort of how much it needs to get. So small scale fading effects and dips you need to recover. Recovery is typically, again, a matter of transmitting at higher color levels. But you've got a trade-off between, accounting for all of the loss and possibly sending at too high a power level when there isn't loss. Okay, so again, the effects are complex, and they're also relative to the bandwidth of our signal, and so we're going to look at an example where it seems, what happens depending on signal bandwidth. So we're going to look at a two-path propagation model with a fixed delay between the paths. And in such a system, you're going to get maximum attenuation every one of the paths. Within this, we're going to look at three different bit rates, 600 bits per second, 0.27 kilobits per second, and 1.22 megabits per second. Okay, so those are going to correspond to different bandwidths for your signal. So, and so, it will then be attenuated, you'll see the attenuation will impact in different ways. Okay. So our 600 bit per second system is what's called a narrow band system, and that means that the periodicity is high, which means that the bandwidth is compressed. It's compressing 600 hertz. And because of the narrow bandwidth, the channel characteristics are going to be pretty much constant over that, over the bandwidth of the signal. And so the signal will be attenuated but not distorted. And this means that it will experience flat fading. And so the danger, of course, is if your bandwidth falls within the maximum attenuation
point, then you're going to lose your signal entirely. If you're outside of that, then you have a good chance of recovering your signal well. Okay, so for a medium bandwidth system, you're going to experience that maximum attenuation at a number of points within your signal bandwidth. So you're going to have, you're going to experience selective fading. Your signal will be distorted, but not attenuated. The delay along the two different paths is going to be longer than a bit period, and so this means that you are going to experience a single interference. And so you're going to have to deal with that as well. Finally, we have our wideband system. And so, again, we have a number of connectors when we're, again, losing notches out of our bandwidth. And we have a delay that goes into quite a number of bit periods. Okay, so we'll have to deal with both of those factors in order to recover your signal. So again, you have these,
you have these effects within the channel and how they interact with the
actual signal sent depends on the characteristics of the signal sent. Broken back my thing again. Okay, so the room has just lost contact with the outside world, but I'll just, there's one more slide. And so the question then becomes, how do you deal with these various channel effects? And the one slide answer is that you introduce diversity, which is, again, some form, you can think of it as some form of redundancy. Okay. And so you want to send multiple logical channels or connections between sender and receiver, and so despite the fact you guys can't see it, I'm recording this, so get this back anyway. Okay, and the
channels of redundancy, the channels of redundancy, take a number of forms. You have space diversity. And so the space diversity, you have multiple physical paths and multiple antennas to combine the transmissions along the different paths and to proceed and combine with the transmissions along different paths. Frequency diversity, we have an idea of trying to spread a signal out frequency bandwidth, and again, flat wave, you might totally eradicate your system. You have broader bandwidth and probably only eradicate portions of your signal. Again, it's fairly easy to adjust, so you can go from that. And possibly you can use time diversity, so it'll spread the data out over time. So this is for informal encoding, digital encoding. Now, we'll return to the idea of space diversity and frequency diversity later in the lecture. We'll use more modern techniques that are used to improve the quality of wireless transmission. But for the moment, we'll leave it there. As I said, next time what we're going to do is see how we can use these path characteristics to design cellular systems. So at least at a very abstract level, how can you provide universal coverage over a large area? And again, we're going to rely on this characteristic of fading at some power of the distance to design our systems. So that's it for today. And so I'll see you guys all next week. Okay, good morning. Last time we were talking about the digital communication systems model, and this is what it takes to get some sort of message from sender to receiver. Across a wireless link, or across sections, I guess we're just point to point, right? And so you know that a messenger's voice, it starts out as an analog signal which we have to digitize. And then we have a stream of bits and we want to process that. We might use a source encoder to compress the number of bits that we're sending. So we reduce what we have to send for efficiency purposes. Once we've done that, we might actually add in some redundancy in order to deal with errors and loss in the channel. And so, through the source encoding and the channel encoder, we then need to translate that stream of bits into a radio frequency signal, which is some form of sinusoidal wave. And so there's a number of ways of doing that, and then that's transmitted over a radio link. Okay, so we left this with the radio link for today. At the other end, naturally, we just unwind everything we've done, so we translate the bits from the radio signal into bits. We interpret them, so we try and do things like error tests and we're going to decode our original encoding. And naturally, our goal is to get the information through correctly as efficiently as possible. Okay, so there's a trade-off between moving 9 bits a second and sort of again resistance to error. So what we're going to look at today is this last piece of the puzzle, the radio link, and we're just going to see what characteristics it has as distinct from a wired link. And again, the main source of the notes is William Stallings, and again, Goldsmith and Black with the detailed discussions of some of these topics. Okay, so we're going to concentrate on this radio channel. Okay. So the
device through which our radio signal is going to be transmitted and received is an antenna. And then we're pretty much just going to assume that they exist and they have certain characteristics. We'll mention them briefly. What we're concerned with mainly is the signal traveling through this channel. And there's a lot of issues that we don't typically consider with wirelessness, most of which have to do with the power at the the power of the received signal relative to the power of the transmitted signal. And this power is decreasing with distance. And we'll see that there's a number of contributing factors that make the way in which this power decreases fairly complicated. Adding to that is the idea of mobility. So we don't have a point-to-point link that we can precisely characterize, because at least one end of our link could vary mobility. And so this is, adds additional complicating factors which we'll go through. Okay. So an antenna is an electrical conductor or system of conductors used for transmission of radio frequencies and reception of radio frequencies. And the same antenna both receives and transmits. Pretty much the only thing that we're going to account for with antennas is that we'll be able to abstractly think of them as radiating in a sphere, or you can think of their radiation and perhaps reception as being directional, as being pointed, the power being pointed in a particular direction. Okay. So antennas in general radiate in three dimensions. Frequently you might see cross sections of that radiation, but most of the pictures I've shown in three representations. Okay. And again, we can give you a little bit of an ideal antenna mounts radiated in all directions, or the antenna has directionality. Which means that you have a maximum direction, there's an optimal direction, and then around that you have what's called beamwidth, which indicates sort of within that direction how spread out the radiation pattern is. And so the beamwidth is the angle within which the power is radiated by the antenna, is at least half of the preferred direction. So again, this angle is going to give you with how concentrated the transmission is in a specific direction. We are going to sum that all up by a term called gain, which again is the power transmitted in any direction versus any direction. And again, in terms of reception, the antenna's reception is equivalent to the radiation pattern. So if you have a
directional antenna that's going to obviously pick up signals in one direction better than it would pick up signals in
any other direction. So, our ideal case, this is an abstract concept, this was called an isotropic antenna. And so the isotropic antenna emits the signal equally in all directions at some fixed power level. And so that power density is measured at some radius d from center. So, in actuality, ideal isotropic antennas can honestly be built. Real antennas, for that reason and because it's useful, tend to concentrate their power in a specific direction, and that's measured by, first of all, the conductivity, and that measure of conductivity is the maximum power density over the mean power density. Okay. And so, in general, if you want to build a directional antenna, you get something like this. So you have a major load, and again, you see that's focusing power in one direction. Typically, you can't completely do that, and you will have some power swinging in other directions. Okay. Now, the factor that's most relevant to us in terms of directional antennas is what's called the gain. And the gain refers to the power output in a specific direction compared to the output of an omnidirectional isotropic antenna. This means that you're emitting the sort of power level, you're now focusing the power in a given direction. So again, for the same power, you get higher signals in a specific direction. The gain is going to be a function of the size and shape of the antenna, and this effect is captured in what's called the effective area of the antenna. And so there's a relationship between the gain and the effective area of the antenna. And then this relationship is variable with the wavelength and or the frequency at which you're transmitting. Okay, so again, the term gain, we're probably
discussing propagation factors.
It's the main one that we concern ourselves with. And so, what types of antennas are there?
Well, we have omnidirectional.
They're not perfectly spherical, but we'll see if you can get something approximating a sphere. Or sectorized, which will again radiate out in specific
directions, or maybe you can get some points of
concentrates the signal in a fairly tight direction.
And so that's what you, those are the types of things you can see on phone mesh, for instance. Obviously, they're a bit big for mobile equipment. And mobile equipment, you get things like microstrip patches or coils of metal, essentially, within the device.
Okay.
So one common type of antenna is the dipole antenna. And it's built from wire that's half a wavelength long and does not radiate in the direction of the ends of the wire. Okay, so you're not going to design quite an ideal. It won't give you quite an ideal S-tropic. In general, what it's going to do is we'll generate radiation patterns which are donut shaped, toroidal, and how many depends on the frequency of emission. So, again, it could be just instead of essentially radiating 60 degrees, you want to radiate outwards in plane, then you can get a gain over an isotropic antenna. Again, you can also use them to come closer to building actual isotropic antenna or something close to an isotropic antenna. Okay, and how you do that depends on the frequencies at which you transmit. And again, your basic dipole, you can transmit at the frequency that it was built at. And you get a single load. If you transmit them at multiple frequencies, you end up getting these multiple loads. And again, you see that you get something that's closer to looking like
360,
but looking at an isotropic radius in all directions.
Again, other antennas are used for a more directional transmission. So one typical way of getting directionality would be through a parabolic antenna. And here again, all of the radiation is focused in a specific outward direction. Okay, so you have this reflective curve and a focus, and if you transmit from the focus, again, it gets the transmission is being reflected out all in a parallel direction, and sort of incoming would be the opposite. Anything you're getting from that parallel direction will be reflected back. Okay, so again, the takeaway points are that the antenna is the device through which you send and receive signals, and depending on the shape and size of the antenna, you can concentrate those signals you can concentrate the signals into a specific direction. And there is a gain factor in that direction, which means for the same power output, you can have more
power traveling in a single direction versus if it was traveling minister in the isotropic directions. Okay. So when the antenna transmits this signal, it then is traveling through the air. And again, what we're primarily concerned with is what happens to it as it travels. And the short answer to that is that the power decreases with distance, from the transmitting antenna. Now, there are three paths that a radio signal can take. First, ground waves follows the contour of the Earth. And it's used for low-frequency signals. And the main example of this would be an AM radio. The main advantage is that you can, the signals will travel a long way. Skywave bounces between the Earth's surface and the outer atmosphere. And so, again, you can travel a long way, also at low frequencies. And so these are radio applications, CB radios, and ham radios, international broadcasts that we were intending to send transmissions to distant countries. The one that we're concerned with is what's called line of sight transmission, and this works at higher frequencies. And as said, you have to have some path from sender to receiver, the initial definition would be sort of an unobstructed path between sender and receiver. As it turns out, well, you can, in some cases, you'll be bouncing off other objects, bending around other objects. You don't actually have to have necessarily physical oversight, but you do have to find a path over which the radio waves travel. So we're going to look at this line of sight propagation, and we're going to see that there are a number of factors that affect the line of sight propagation and affect the power at which the signal is received. First of these is free space loss, and that says just no matter what, you're out in the middle of space, your signal is going to decrease in strength. Since we're not out in space, other factors are going to have an impact as well. Even just sending through the air, the vegetation is going to bounce around and refract through the air, and so in the atmospheric absorption, in the further decreasing signal. And because, again, our path from sender to, or our line of sight from sender to receiver might have objects in the way, and we're going to bounce off those objects, possibly we have to block the signal. You have multi-path effects, and so you start with, again, your original transmission. By the time it arrives at the receiver, it will be traveling along a number of different paths. And so you get a number of copies of the central signal all arriving at the receiver, and they are combined with slightly different characteristics because of the different path that they took and then combined. Difficult to predict ways. Okay. And again, on top of all of that, you have mobility. So it's not like you've got your senders fixed in one position, your receiver fixed in another. One or both of them could possibly be moving. And again, that will cause somewhat difficult to predict changes to the signal. Okay, so we're going to have a look at how these various factors impact on our signal, and particularly on the digital signal, as opposed to just a random radio wave. And we're going to see that the models that you can use to represent this are relatively complex. Typically, it's difficult to come up with analytic models. A lot of times, people resort to models based on empirical data. So you actually go around the city and you observe signal strengths. So you go around building and you observe signal strengths. And you kind of generalize from what you observe. Okay, so we use the term fading to refer to the reduction of the power of a transmitted signal, determined by the position of the receiver relative to the transmitter. These effects are related to the distance from the transmitter, and also the interference experienced by the intervening terrain, and also, if we missed out, the mobility of the sender and receiver. Usually we classify these effects into two categories. We have large-scale fading effects, or small-scale fading effects. Large-scale fading effects are due to the large distance between sender and receiver. So if I'm making a mobile phone call, the receiver could be a mile away. And so again, my power is increasing based on that distance, and possibly also what the terrain is like between me and the receiver. Small scale fading effects, the large scale fading, it's not going to change much if I walk from this end of the room to the other end of the room. So over short distances, it's not going to change much. Small-scale fading effects are observed with small changes in the position of sender relative to receiver. So again, if I walk from the center room to the other end of the room, I could very well experience small-scale fading effects. And we'll see that, again, they're based on these small changes in position and also on motion. Okay, so just because just the fact that they're moving change what would change the signal. Okay.
Now, what impact
Do these effects have on the signal? Well, there's two possibilities. One is signal attenuation, and this just means, again, the amplitude of the signal decreases, the power in the signal decreases. Okay. And so what you need then is to transmit at sufficient power that at the receiving end, you are able to overcome noise effects. Okay. Having said that, you want to make balance of not sort of over either overpowering the receiver circuitry or taxing your signaling device as well. So you want to use enough power that all can just. Now, if your signal covers a larger frequency bandwidth, then it's possible that certain portions of that band, of that frequency bandwidth, are affected in a different way than other portions. So the attenuation is not uniform over the full bandwidth. And in this case, the changes to the signal will not be uniform, and you get distortion of the signal. Okay. This may or may not be a problem, depending on again, how easy it is to recover the bit in the presence of distortion. So if you have an analog signal, for instance, then it's difficult to recover from distortion. For bits, you may be able to. Okay, so we're going to go over the two forms of fading, so our large scale fading and our small scale fading. And again, we'll start with large scale fading, it's a bit more straightforward. And the primary components of large scale fading is free space loss. And so no matter what, again, your signal is going to attenuate. And the attenuation factor is related to the square of the distance between sender and receiver. Okay. Assuming we have gains in our transmitter and receiver, we have to account for the gains. And then, again, we get the wavelength of transmission and the distance. And so, again, the main term that we're going to hang out to here is the change is with distance squared. Naturally, you can relate the gains to the area, and so you just deal with one term or the other. Okay. look at is the power at the receiver. And so you can see that's the power of the transmitter, boosted by any gain factor, and diminished by the distance squared. Okay. The loss is the ratio of the power of the receiver to the power of the transmitter. And again, the farther you go, the greater the distance, the greater the loss. And if you want to, you can put that all into decibels as well.
Again, it's just,
the nice thing about decibels is you can isolate out. You can isolate out the individual factors.
Okay.
In order to sort of simplify the system, frequently we measure the power received relative to a standard reference point or standard reference distance. Okay. And so in this case, the ratio of the power received to the power at the specific distance is just relative to V0 over D, of course, all squared. Okay. And so again, we see the factor count is that the power received is proportional to 1 over D squared.
Now, additional to our pre-space laws, we get what is called shadowing. And shadowing is just the impact of the terrain on this specific signal. And so basically, again, as you send your signal, you may have a line of sight path to the receiver. But in addition to this, the transmitting signal is going to be reflecting off other objects. So it can reflect off buildings, reflect off the ground, reflect off a number of different objects. And every time it does that, you can think of it as a signal taking a different path to the destination. The signal can be bent around objects, so if you sort of cut the corner, bending around the object. And the signal can also sort of diffuse through the less dense objects. Okay. What this means is that in addition to getting signal received along the direct route, it travels along any number of different routes to the receiver. And the main issue with that is that these different routes are all of different length, and therefore the signal is slightly changed. Essentially, the phase of the signal ends up being changed. And so when all of these signals combine at the receiver, you may get a greater or smaller amplitude for the signal. Okay. So this shadowing leads to what's called a multipath effect. Again, we're getting multiple copies of our signal being received. This can either reinforce or cancel out the original signal. Okay. So this has, again, a couple of different effects when you think about the transmission bits. So if you think about the transmission of single bits, again, you get this idea that either enhancing the signal or interference signal, but additionally, depending on the path that they travel out, they travel on, if you're sending a train of bits, then you may have two separate bits being received, or more than one different bit being received at the same time. So this effect of the signals traveling along different paths, which take different amounts of time to arrive, is referred to as time dispersion. And time dispersion causes what's called inter-symbol interference. Okay. And see what that is in our example. So we can think of our signal traveling along two separate paths. Okay. One is direct, and the other is it's bouncing off some distant mountain. Okay. And if we think a chain of signal or the chain of bits or a train of bits being sent, then again, the train once arrives directly at the receiver, and another one is taking a long time as it bounces off some distant object. What that means is that possibly at the time where along the direct path, you've received your first bit, and you're now receiving your second bit. That's when the reflection of the first bit arrives at your receiver. And so you have the bits, the symbols interfering with each other. And again, the hope is that if this traveled a much longer path, then it's also, we hope, attenuated a lot of the received at the receiver. So, but it still does add to such an enormous factor in reception. Beyond that, again, even within a single signal, you can have, if you have multiple paths, you can have the signals traveling along these different paths and combining, again, to give a slightly different version of the signal. Okay. Now, again, typically, you're going to have a lot of different paths, and it becomes very difficult to predict exactly how the signal will be impacted. What we're going to do is look at the sender and the receiver out in the middle of a field somewhere, on a very flat plane somewhere. So you're going to get two copies of your signal. You're going to get your direct line of sight copy, and you're going to get a second copy bouncing
being received. Okay. And so we're going to look at, well, for this specific case, how the signals combine. So, we'll consider our normalized free space loss equation. So, we have our power at a specific distance and then the power at some distance d. And so, the signals being transmitted are sinusoidal. And whether they can combine or interfere is sort of to be dependent on the phase shift relative to each other, so the difference in phase. So for a single signal, we can represent it in the imaginary realm as so our sine becomes e to the I 2 pi f t minus tau, so the difference in the time for the two signals. Okay. J 2 pi f t, and so that term can be pulled out, and J t, so again our phase shift. Okay. And so our received power is going to be the sum of the power received along both paths. And so it's going to be a function of the distance traveled and the relative phase of the two signals. Okay. And so we take the difference between our two signals. Okay, and so what we need to do is figure out what this difference term amounts to, and so we need to look at what the distances d1 and d2, and then the phase differences phi1 and phi2. Okay. Now, the distance along the direct path is difference in the antenna heights, squared plus d squared, square root of all that, so there's a right angle triangle there. And the distance along the indirect path is going to be the sum of the two heights plus d squared squared. Okay. Now, if we assume that d is much bigger than our antenna heights, then both of those terms are close to d, so we can approximate both d1 and d2 as d. This leaves us with our phases, phi, and again, we can combine them now into a term delta phi. And delta phi is a function of our frequency and the difference of the distance traveled.
in order to find the difference in the distance traveled delta D, we use a Taylor expansion on D1 and D2. And so we look at just the first two terms of that Taylor expansion. And when we take the difference, all these disappear, and we're left with the difference between H1 minus H2 squared and H1 plus H2 squared, which is 2 H1 over H2, and then that's all. There it's 4, and then over 2D. Okay. So anyway, we can get the delta D solution. The difference in phase, and it's a function now of the antenna heights and the overall distance between sender and receiver. So we plug that delta D term in now. And we say we observe that again, H1 and H2 are much smaller than D, so delta D is small. So we can approximate E through J delta D by 1 minus J delta D. And when we plug that in, of course, we're left with this delta D term, so the 1 minus EJ to delta D, and that's squared. We plug in our value for delta D in terms of H1, H2, and D. And we get now that we've added essentially an extra d squared term. Our power is now dropping with d to the fourth. So we've changed from the power dropping in free space as d squared, now the power is dropping. Again, this is the result you would get in a fairly uncomplicated landscape. Again, thinking something like a plane with nothing on it besides your sender and receiver. Obviously, that's not what is out there. If you think about a city, you've got tall buildings, you have the terrain, might have hills or valleys or whatever, so you get a much more complicated picture than just this bouncing up once off the ground. Okay. So, one approach to dealing with this problem is to come up with empirical models for how loss occurs or within different types of terrain. Okay. So typically these models within things like buildings and rooms, there's a lot of work to actually grind out how many paths do you have and what the characteristics of those paths are. In general, certain outdoor areas, you have empirical models which make extensive observations of a single setting and build a model based on those observations and then try to generalize from this setting to other settings. And so I'm going to show you three different models that take this approach. Being built up on empirical data, and they want you to appreciate coming out of this is just, what's the general approach of the models, and how the model
differ from each other in their approach, and then sort of the limitations of this sort of approach are. So we'll start with the Lee model, which is relatively simple, and is based on data from Los Angeles in California. We'll look at the Akamura model, which is based on Tokyo data. And again, it's a more detailed model. And then we'll look at the Hatha model, which was an essential attempt to somewhat simplify the Akamura model. Again, we'll sort of observe just to start that they are all based on specific empirical data, empirical data. And so they are, to some extent, applying them, you need to consider whether your situations in any way relates to the original scenarios on which you space. So, for instance, Tokyo is a bit like Dublin, but bigger. It's a very flat city. Los Angeles has pockets of high buildings here and there. So, and again, the characteristics of the terrain differ. You question how relevant something like, Lee or the Akamura model would be to New York City, where it's all skyscrapers, for instance. So the applicability, you struggle a bit. Realism. Okay. So again, the Lee model is based on Los Angeles data. And the measurements are taken at a specific frequency. Again, it was related to the cellular system at the time. And so what you get is that your power decreases with distance according to some factor gamma. And again, that factor gamma is then correlated to different scenarios. Okay. It also is relative to frequency. And again, according to some factor n, and n is again related to topography of your application. And then it inserts another correction factor, F0. Okay, which is a function of things like n. So again, the first factors, P0 and gamma, are selected experimentally based on measurements. Okay, and so they've been done in sort of generic cases. And then for specific cities. So the F0 correction factor is a function of the antennas being used, so their heights and their gain factors. N is a function of the topography. And it differs depending on whether you're in a suburban or an urban area.
And so, again,
the original data was measured according to a specific scenario, so fixed carrier frequency, antenna heights, gains, etc.
Okay. So, again, the
interesting thing about it is that it is an attempt to characterize quite a complex system according to relatively
small number of inputs. Okay.
Again, there's a number of these types of models. One of the most commonly used now is the Akamura model,
and it's a bit more detailed than the Lee model. It's
possibly a bit more accurate, but again, it's initially based on measurements for the city of Tokyo, which has a very specific topological They consider now a larger range of frequencies, and you can extrapolate. So they take a bunch of actually measure everything at multiple frequencies and multiple antenna heights. And so, in place of the equations that Lee has, they have sets of curves which give attenuation relative to free space frequencies and antenna heights, etc. And they use the sets of curves as the correction factors.
Okay, so as before, you have
you try to determine free space loss. Your loss. And it's phrased slightly differently as the 50th percentile propagation loss, which means that it's the loss experienced by half of your signal. And it's obviously a function of free space loss and then a number of these corrective factors. Okay, so the graph, the interplay between frequency and distance, use that as a corrective factor. And then they have a number of gain factors, which are related to antenna heights, and then again, just the type of terrain you might be using.
Okay.
So again, they correct free space loss relative to frequency and distance. And then they correct according to terrain. And again, that's relative to the frequency that you're using.
And they also take antenna height into account. Okay. And again, in order to do this, they have
measurements and they graph those measurements.
So,
again, I'm not going to dwell on the example. Essentially, in order to find your path loss, you're going to have to take each of these factors into account
and then again refer to the graphs. Okay, so you can calculate free space loss.
You refer to the chart to find A at a specific frequency and distance.
And then you again refer to
the charts to find the different gain factors and the cycles to land you're in.
Okay. So
quite a detailed model, and again, at least for Tokyo, it was already predicted the attenuation within Tokyo pretty well. And again, there's a lot of interesting how well it can be mapped onto other cities and terrains. One drawback of this model is the fact that you have to keep referring back to these
all of these different charts. So, our last model that we're going to look at is the Hata model, and essentially you took the Akabura model and then tried to simplify the charts into a mathematical equation. In order to do that naturally, you're going to lose some axes. So, again, you get the same thing as function of frequency of antenna gains and antenna heights.
Okay. And so you have correction factors for all of these terms.
The correction factors, again, depend on frequency and possibly terrain.
So, again, you have, depending on terrain, you have slightly different equations. And so, again, it slightly simplifies the Akabura model. It's still complex, and there's still the issue of some relevance to any specific topology. Okay, and people have worked on improving on these models over the years, I should say.
Okay, so that's an example of what people do to try and figure out what exactly your reception strength is. Likely, if you're trying to site an antenna, for instance, what you'll be doing actually is taking measurements.
Okay. Now, as we continue with the course, the takeaway factor of this is just that power loss is characterized by a drop off with some factor of the distance. Okay. And we'll assume that this the factor of power is between 2 and 5.5. Next week, when we look at sort of cellular systems, we'll see what
abstractly think about how you lay out cellular systems. Okay, so that's large scale fading, and moving forward, that's pretty much.
pretty much what we're going to concern ourselves with.
Again, there are, because of the mobility of the sender and our receiver, you also get effects that are noticeable with small changes of the distance between sender and receiver. Then, if you're thinking about the mobile system, just walking, you will observe significant changes in the characteristics of the channel. So, I'm going to take the break now, and when we return, we'll talk about the small scale.